Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and glad to be with you this afternoon. You know, one thing I've noticed, 26 years now at Stand to Reason. I just realized, January to February to March, April to May. We're just 4 months off of 27 years. Is that right? Did I do that right? 27 years with STR. Amazing. One of the things I noticed, though, early on, is that almost everybody that came to our events were guys. And sometimes there were gals that were dragged along. And it was kind of obvious they were dragged along. You know, the guy was interested in this stuff, but the gal wasn't. This has changed tremendously, radically, in the last 20 years. And I think about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years into the process of Stand to Reason, which now would be 20 years ago, I began to see a shift. And something the Holy Spirit was doing, expanding, generally speaking, people's interest in thoughtful Christianity, and that it involved more women coming on board. And, of course, many of you know about Nancy Piercy. She's been around for a long time. But people like Amy Hall here at Stand to Reason, Natasha Crane, who's been sitting in the, she's sat in for me, or she's certainly been on the show before, Alyssa Childers, and a whole bunch more are kind of entering into the fray. But one who's been around for quite a long time in the enterprise, Krista Bontrager, and she's been with Reasons to Believe. And Krista, she's online with me today. We're going to chat a little bit. Krista, I'm trying to remember how long we've known each other, and it seems to me you are around when we were doing the Little Green Men thing. Were you there?
Yeah, I was the producer on that, and then you and I were in seminary together at Talbot way back in the 90s.
Oh my goodness, that's a long time. Well,
yes.
You have been a faithful worker for Reasons to Believe, and you are now, what, a theology mom? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I work at Reasons to Believe. I'm one of the staff scholars there. I'm one of the theologians, along with Kenneth Samples,
right,
which I'm sure you've had on your show before.
I have. In fact, I was in your studio with Ken Samples about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So we did a show because of the tactics book that's just come out. So it was great
right.
to be there.
Yeah.
I just didn't see you.
Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thanks a lot.
I've been there about 21 years
now.
My goodness. And then prior to that, I taught theology at Biola University. I taught undergrad and before I had children. And theology mom is just kind of my side ministry where I get to talk about other topics that I'm interested in when I'm at work. And at Reasons to Believe, I do science-based things. And
right.
when I'm off work, I talk about other things.
Well, I'm thrilled that you're doing that. And I didn't realize how long you had been with RTB, but they have always been dear to our heart. You guys have been, and you know the close relationship our organizations have. And Hugh reminded me, I think about a year ago when he was on the air sitting in the studio here, that he and I knew each other before either of us had organizations. So we go way, way back. And and so we're glad to be able to encourage you guys, as you've encouraged us in different ways that we work together. For people who don't know about the reference to Little Green Men, there was you guys had a book and also a kind of a DVD thing where there was a group of people I was moderating as kind of the host, and you guys had your smart folk around the table, and you were producing that project. And what was the book called? Little Green Men? What was that?
Yeah, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. It came out about 18, 19 years ago now. It's with Hugh Ross, Kenneth Samples, and Dr. Mark Clark, looking at the phenomenon of UFOs and abduction experiences.
Right. And that's still available, isn't it?
Yes, it is still in print and available through Reasons to Believe.
Yeah, at reasons.org, by the way.
Yes.
But now, Krista, one of the reasons that I have you on this week is because you are also involved with the board of directors of a group called Women in Apologetics, which is what I kind of opened with. And have you noticed in your tenure there with RTV an increasing interest like I have of women in thoughtful Christianity?
Very much so. When I started at Reasons to Believe in 1999, there were not a lot of women on the horizon. I mean, even when I was in seminary, I remember going through quite a lot of questioning whether or not a woman could even be a theologian. I mean, here I was in seminary dedicating my life to this, but I was the only woman in the program at Talbot at the time. When I graduated, I was the first woman that taught theology in the theology department at Biola. And there was really nobody I could look to and say, oh, there's a woman who's doing what I want to do. And I want to aspire to be like that. But now, like you said, there's just been such a growth of women coming into apologetics. When we first started offering classes about 18 years ago at Reasons to Believe, about 90% of our students were men. And now in our courses, 50% at least are women.
Yeah.
And so it is definitely shifted.
Well, I'm so glad to see that. And it, I don't usually like kind of doing assessments along gender lines, but this seemed to be such a glaring imbalance, not for anybody's fault. I'm not that, that's not my project here, but just because this is just where people's interest was lying at the time, and now that seems to be shifting, and I think that's better for the church. It's better for the body of Christ. It's better for moms. So your mom's in theology, mom. You're speaking to a slice of people that I'm not going to be able to speak as effectively to. It's kind of like Natasha Crane and the work that she's doing with moms and others, Mama Bear Apologetics, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm really glad to see that people with your qualifications, Krista, are making the kind of contribution that you're making, both in apologetics and in theology. And of course, we know, you and I know, and many listening know, these things go together. They are not, strictly speaking, separate disciplines. They're joined at the hip. They have a little different focus, but they're still critical to each other. And so you then can bring to the table things in both those areas that people like myself can't, because you have access to a different group. So tell me a little bit. I know you've got a conference coming up, and I want our people to know about your conference coming up. Tell us about the Women in Apologetics Conference.
Sure. This is our third conference, and it's going to be at Biola University in La Mirada. And it's called, obviously, it's called the Women in Apologetics Conference. And basically, the idea behind the conference is to platform women who are working in the realm of theology and apologetics. And, you know, sometimes, and this is another one of the shifts that's happening, you know, it used to be in the old days, you'd go to an apologetics conference, all the speakers would be men. Now that's changing. Mary Jo Sharp is out there.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention Mary Jo. My
yeah,
bad on that
Melissa
one.
Melissa Kane Travis, Natasha Crane, these gals are coming up. They're getting on the speaking circuit, and that's awesome.
Right.
And there's a lot of up-and-coming women, but we wanted to create a space where newcomers could come, get a platform, and speak and hone their craft, as well as women apologists. And so Women in Apologetics, we're kind of a network of women who are working in the realm of apologetics in all different realms and aspects of defending the faith, but coming together for this conference and helping to provide an on-ramp to many people who are just usually trying to get into the conversation about defending our faith.
Oh, so, that's really interesting. I work a lot with Frank Turek, who you know, with his CIA, Cross-Examine Instructor Academy, and it's a very, there are some similarities in the sense that trying to reach out for those who are in play in some fashion, desire to make a bigger difference in this area, and helping them move forward a little bit by giving information and helping them groom their skills. So I like the way you explain this as an on-ramp, as it were. So are you hoping to draw for your conference only from those who kind of have ambitions for developing skills as apologists, or are you, what about others who just are basically interested? Are you throwing the net a little wider for this conference?
Definitely wider, and we want to get everyone engaged. We want to encourage other women who are aspiring to be apologists, but we also want to encourage anyone out there who's maybe just discovering apologetics and they want to come out, or maybe some veterans too. You know, we're going to have some very unique sessions at the conference, and it's not just a women's conference. All the speakers will be women, but men are definitely invited and welcomed and wanted. It's just, you know, we always like to make that distinction. It's not a women's conference, although the majority of people that come are women. And we do offer an awesome and amazing children's program where they're not just getting child care, but they're actually getting training in defending their faith as well. And so it's wonderful because many women, this is often a hindrance for women, they're not able to attend conferences because of child care issues.
Yeah.
And so we want to remove that obstacle for a lot of moms of young kids and say, hey, bring your kids. We're going to help train them as well.
Okay, so this is January 24th and 25th at Biola. At what time is it starting, like Friday evening there, what, 6 or 7?
Yeah, it's
I didn't even look at my calendar. 24 and 25th, I'm presuming, is Friday and Saturday. Is that right?
Yes, it's a Friday night and all day Saturday, and people can find out the full schedule and registration information just by going to womeninapologetics.com. And we have two options available. They can come live and in person to the conference, but we also have a live streaming option so that people can catch us no matter where they are in the world.
Wow. Well, that's convenient. So if they have to stick with their kids, they can't leave them even in your care, and you have some good things planned for the young folk there, they can stay at home and still catch the conference. Can you give us an idea of some of the topics that will be covered either in the plenaries or the breakouts that you'll be doing?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And we're going to have a couple of friends from Ravi Zacharias Ministries. Joe Vitale is going to be joining us. And Alicia Wood is going to be there as well. And we're going to also hear from our friend Jeannie Jones is going to be another speaker. And she's done some great Bible studies on the Old Testament. She's going to be speaking about that. And then our friend Hillary Ferrer from Mama Bear Apologetics is doing another one of the keynotes. So those are kind of our lead speakers. And as far as I would really like to highlight a couple of our breakout sessions, too. One of them is going to be very unique is we're going to be doing one on art, the arts in apologetics, and how to use art as a means of defending the faith. And we're going to have a breakout session that I'm going to be doing with the co-host on the TV show that I do. We're going to be talking about critical race theory and how that is coming into a lot of evangelical churches.
Well, I was happy to see this. In fact, I thought there was a typo here, the Great Awakening.
Yes, that's the name of our talk.
Because, of course, woke is a term in the discipline that is bandied about a lot that has to do with critical race theory. And this is something that just consuming certain aspects of our culture and consequently consuming Christianity in certain aspects, particularly progressive Christianity, it seems. It's a danger. I was a little surprised to see this because it's somewhat a rarefied topic in a certain sense. It's a big deal now. Obviously, it's out there, but it's not like the standard thing you'd see on an apologetics curriculum for a conference, but I'm glad that you're addressing it. Can you maybe spend a few moments to explain what you mean by the Great Awakening and the notion of critical race theory and how it's influencing worldview?
Sure. And people may have heard of the term woke. It's often you see it on Twitter and on social media, and they might not have really even known, what does that word even mean?
Yeah, like W-O-K-E, woke.
Yes, and talk about people being woke. And what it is it's an idea that comes out of something that's been around in the academic realm for about 30, 40 years. It came out of legal studies. And it is an idea of looking at culture and looking at cultural structures through the lens of kind of two categories, putting people either in a category of those who are oppressed or the oppressors. And everyone sort of falls in one of those categories. And people may have heard of the idea of, you know, being a white Christian male and how some of the cultural narrative is break or smash the patriarchy. And, you know, that we need to kind of smash these ideas and these structures in our culture. Critical race theory is an aspect of critical theory that focuses on race and the idea of how do we as different, how do we as white people interact with those who are of different races, and how are we to understand our white privilege? This is a term that's coming out a lot, that we have a certain amount of privilege simply by being white people, and that people who are of other people of color are in an oppressed category. And
victims.
Now that the culture is breaking down this way, but these ideas are also coming into the church.
Yeah.
The Southern Baptist Convention just adopted a resolution this past summer that critical race theory is an analytical tool that can be used to help us in our understanding of Scripture. And so this is a very important idea for us to understand where it comes from, how it's acting as a worldview lens for many people in their early and mid-20s. This is the dominant view of that people are getting in college now, even at Christian colleges.
Yeah.
So we want to raise awareness about that.
It's really scary, the creep of this point of view, and you're dealing with the racial issue, but the broader critical theory covers all this intersectionality, all these different victim groups, you know, and of course, if somebody's a victim because they're oppressed, that means that there's somebody who is a victimizer, who is the oppressor, who is guilty, as it turns out, in virtue of their gender or sexual preference or skin color or something like that. We won't get into that. Obviously, now it's complex, but I'm glad that you're addressing it. And I think this summary that you gave will give folks and the ladies especially who'd be going to this event a little idea of what you're going to be offering in that particular that's a breakout session. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And my co-teacher has been a vocal advocate for critical race theory for the last two decades, and she is now coming out of that perspective. And she's been working in social services and in the realm of sociology. And she has seen it come into the churches with a fury and is really starting to be vocal about cautioning Christians about going down this path.
Well, that's really great. Standard apologetics topics issues during some of the sessions?
Yeah, definitely. We're going to be talking about abortion. We're going to be talking about the resurrection and the evidence for the resurrection. My colleague from Reasons to Believe, Dr. A.J. Roberts, will be speaking on science and the Christian faith and a bit about her journey as a research scientist. We're going to definitely be talking about the problem of pain, evil, and suffering. So there's going to be some traditional discussions as well as some very unique things responding to what's happening in our culture.
Well, Krista, congratulations for the good work you've been doing all these years, and now the encouragement that you're giving to other women to find their voice. And I think, isn't that the kind of the theme of the conference this year?
Yes, it is the theme, yes.
And so once again, the conference is January 24th, Friday evening. What time does it start on Friday?
I am looking for that right as we speak. Doors open at 6 o'clock, and we will be starting at 6:30.
Yeah, okay. This is off kind of the 5 and the 91 in La Mirada, Biola, of course. That means leave early.
That's right.
Because there's traffic on Friday. But so Friday night and all day Saturday, January 25th at Biola University. Get all the information you need at womeninapologetics.com. Did I get that right, Krista?
That's correct, yes.
And Krista and her colleagues will be there. Amy, are you going to that? Did I see some information? Are you attending? Okay, Amy's going to be there, too. Oh, we're going to have a table. Okay, Stand to Reason has a table there. That's good. Thank you for that. And I highly recommend this, and it's going to be a unique experience for the ladies. It'll be a little bit different in some ways because of the kind of presentations and the presenters. So I hope you have a grand weekend there, January 24th and 25th, Krista.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's a treat. Okay, God's best to you all at RTB. Say hi to the crowd for me, and
I will.
We'll try to send folks your way, okay?
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye now. That's Krista Bontrager at Reasons to Believe. Once again, womeninapologetics.com, and the conference is January 24th and 25th at Biola University, La Mirada, right here in the Los Angeles area. Let's take a break and then back to your calls.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All righty, folks. Greg Kokel back at you here. One of the good guys. Equipping you to think. Every Tuesday night, that's when we have the live show from 4 until 6. And you can dial up 855-243-9975 during that time, Los Angeles time, because that's where I'm at. All right, let's go to Fairfax, Virginia, where it's 3 hours later. And this is Joshua. Hello, Joshua. I'm sorry. Hold on just a minute. I messed up. Wrong line. Okay. Okay, Joshua, that's you. Sorry about that.
Hi, Dr. Kokel. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. My
sure.
dad and I called you online and watch your videos, so I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. So I understand you're an eighth grader.
Yes, I am.
Wow, you sound very well spoken so far. Good
Thank
for you.
You.
What's on your mind?
So my friends and I often have discussions about homosexuality, and they get really mad when I use the Bible to say it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I explain to them in non-biblical terms that homosexuality is wrong?
Well, this is going to be a little bit more difficult to do. And it's not that a case can't be made, but I'm just thinking about what you shared with me so far. You have talked with your friends who don't share your view, and who seem to be belligerent regarding it, because when you say, well, the Bible says that it's wrong, they get really angry. Well, that's different than saying they just disagreed. So they've got some kind of emotional investment here. And just to keep in mind, when people have their emotions heavily involved in something, they are not usually in a persuasive mood. And if they're not in a persuasive mood, then they are not inclined to give your reasons a fair hearing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And also, there's different ways of talking about the Bible's position on homosexuality. And what I mean is there's different ways to convey the information that the Bible gives. And I don't know how it is you're engaging your friends at this point. If you might be just be, and I'm not assuming anything, but for example, you might just be saying, well, the Bible says it's wrong and it's wrong. And without any further reason for them to think they should listen to what the Bible has to say, and then their reaction is a little understandable. If what you're doing is using the Bible in a little bit more creative way, like maybe talking about Jesus, because people like Jesus, this tactic, by the way, is called, I call it, what a friend we have in Jesus, you know, because people like him. So if we can put our view in Jesus' mouth, so to speak, legitimately. In other words, if he shares our view, then let him talk about our view instead of us. Then they have to. Then they are dealing with Jesus, which is less likely to reject than dealing with you or me. Okay, so there are different ways that you can approach taking the biblical perspective. In fact, I had a caller last hour, and we were. I think it was last hour. Where we were talking about this issue where Jesus made it clear his view about sexuality in Matthew 19, which essentially is one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. And that covers not just homosexuality, but fornication and adultery as well. And so then we say, well, do you think Jesus was wrong about this? Okay, now we're shifting this back to the people who disagree with us about homosexuality, but we're letting them now take issue with Jesus instead of with us. So there's a little bit of a tactical maneuver there that might help you if you're using the Bible, okay?
Yeah.
So, but then there's the other side, and I'll talk about that now. I just wanted to make the point first, before I answered your specific question, that there are more or less productive ways of using the Bible. So that's the point that I was making there. Now, with regards to making the case against homosexuality without using the Bible, the reason this is difficult is because most people have some convictions that are below the surface, or sometimes they're right on the surface, and that conviction is, if it feels good, it's okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you have a person that believes that if it feels good, it's okay for the person who's doing it, then if homosexuality feels good to a person, then it's okay. That's their moral equation. And it's going to be difficult to try to persuade them otherwise unless you deal with the underlying conviction that is, if it feels good, it's okay. There's all kinds of sexual contact that feels good, but it doesn't mean that it's right.
Yeah.
So I think this is a difficult task, and this is why I'm balking here for a moment, because I'm trying to think about what I would say to a person in that circumstance and the standard way of doing it. Okay, I'm saying the standard way, not because I think it's going to be persuasive, because where people are at nowadays, like I said, feels good, do it. Then that's what matters to them. But things are made for certain purposes, all right? So a pencil sharpener is not made for sharpening your fingers, but for sharpening pencils. If you stuck your finger into a pencil sharpener, you would not be using either your finger or your pencil sharpener the way it was made to be used. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so if you take that idea that things ought to be used for the purposes they were made for, and if we don't use it the way they were intended to be used, it could cause trouble.
Yeah.
Now you're into a different way of looking at it, right? Okay, so the question is, given human bodies, I mean, we're not going to talk about the Bible. We're just going to talk about what we know about human bodies, that male sexual organs are made for female sexual organs. Really obvious. They fit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. And by the way, that's how humans reproduce.
Yeah.
So there is a made-for kind of argument here. One part goes into another part in a complementary way, and not only do the parts complement each other, but the genders, male and female, complement each other. And this should not be controversial.
Yes. Even
if people could say, well, there could be other genders, I say, oh, yeah, well, I'm not going to fuss with that right now. Let's just talk about this. Isn't it obvious that a male sexual organ fits a female sexual organ? Okay, and this is why when those organs are used the way they, for what they're made, then, and you don't even have to even say nature made them this way if you want to. I mean, we don't have to even get into God, but we, you and I know that God made them that way. It seems like they're made for something. There's a purpose there. When they're made that way, good things result. Babies, that's how you propagate your family, you know. And there's pleasure involved, too, but it's connected. The pleasure is connected to the proper use.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Yeah. So when the pleasure is connected to the proper use, there's not any question about the propriety of the pleasure. You are doing something that's proper. That brings pleasure. So the pleasure is an added plus. It isn't proper because it brings pleasure. There's all kinds of things that bring us pleasure. You know, you say that aren't proper. Sometimes it might make you feel good to bust your buddy in the chops or something, you know, or your brother or your sister, or, you know, whatever. We have all kinds of impulses that would feel good to do. We say no because that's not the right thing to do. So feeling good isn't the standard.
Exactly.
Okay, so what happens then, by the way? Notice when I was using the illustration about the finger and the pencil sharpener. Well, that's obvious. The minute you stick your finger in that pencil sharpener, it starts to grind. It hurts. It causes damage. Okay. Yeah, it's true in the illustration, but sometimes when we use things in a wrong way, the damage shows up later. All right? And so this is the case. I'm just speaking generally now about sexuality being used in a way that was not consistent for the way that our bodies were made and what God intended.
Exactly.
So it's not just homosexuality, but fornication and adultery too. Because look, you've got relation. You have an activity now that produces children, in principle at least, in a way, in a circumstance where it's not going to be good for the children. Like you don't have a family that's intact in fornication, and you have other families involved in adultery that are going to be broken up. This is not a good thing. And God, it's not rocket science to look at our culture and see the harm that has come to even friends of yours, maybe you, through divorce and broken families and illicit, inappropriate use of the things that God has made for something good. Now, I think I know you're following everything that I'm talking about here, and you see the sensibility of it. And so the harm that comes from pregnancies out of wedlock to people, and the health problems that are almost never spoken of, but are rampant in the gay community, rampant, particularly the male homosexuals, because of the nature of their sexual behaviors, in which they're using their sex organs in a way that is not the way they were intended to be used. And so they get sick.
Yes.
All right. And this may be down the line, but this is what ends up happening. The difficulty here is, in answering the morality of this question, it takes some reflection on the nature of things and the way they're made and what they're for. And it also takes some wisdom to think about longer-term consequences.
Yes.
Neither of those things are things that young people have much of anymore.
Yes.
And present company excluded, of course. That's why you're talking with me. You're thinking about these things. But young people don't think about that. They think, especially when the culture is encouraging them, they think about what feels good. And this is what adults are supposed to train out of young people. It's an adult's job to say that's stupid thinking. That's going to create all kinds of problems down the line. Yeah. Here's wisdom. Here's the way things work. But nowadays you have adults telling kids to do stupid things. And they do stupid things. And then, you know, you sow to the wind and you reap the whirlwind.
Exactly.
And then thinking longer term, you know, young people don't, they can't, they're not good at that. I remember, this is a little side note, Joshua, but I was a real fan of a musical duo called Simon and Garfunkel back in the 60s and early,
oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, I'm glad to hear you recognize them. But they had a song called Old Friends, and what and they were in their mid-20s, I think, at the time, or late-20s. I was in my early-20s. And there's a line in this song that says, how terribly strange to be 70. So these young people who were writing this song, they couldn't imagine what it was like to look that far down the line. Young
yeah.
people don't do that. They think they live forever. And I remember thinking myself, you know, wow, man, 70, I can't even count that high. You know, guess what? In 4 months, I'll be 70.
Oh, no way.
Absolutely. What was that? Is that the Peanut Gallery laughing in the background? Whoa. And by the way, Peanut Gallery, that dates me too. Anyway, yes. And so the point I'm making is when you're older, you look further down the line. When you're younger, you don't see that. And this is why the arguments or the explanation that I've offered you, though I think it's sound as far as it goes, may not be very persuasive with your friends. So don't get your hopes up.
Yes.
But be nice, okay?
Yes.
And I would encourage you, insofar as you advance a biblical morality, don't do it in a shallow way. Try to give some understanding of, you know, bring Jesus into it if you can, and say God made the world a certain way, you know, and if we work the way God made the world, it's better for us. If we work against it, it's going to hurt us. And this is exactly what's happening in the way we're using our sexuality nowadays. That's the kind of thing I'd say. And then, you know, see where it goes from there.
Exactly.
So I tip my hat to you, Joshua, in Fairfax, Virginia, eighth grader, for your thinking about this and your willingness to engage your friends. Good for you.
Thank you. This was very helpful.
Well, that's good. I'm very glad to hear that. All the best to you, Joshua. Give me a call anytime, all right?
Okay. God bless you this new year.
Oh, happy new year to you. Bye-bye now. That was pretty cool. I mean, it was cool on the Joshua side. Is that his name? You took the thing down. Yeah, Joshua. Now I'm looking at Jacob coming up here, and I'm getting the names mixed up. Yeah, that was very cool. You know, some things, friends, are just the kinds of things that a mind given to a certain value system is not going to make any sense of at all. And the kind of argument that I offered just a moment ago is sound. It's a natural law kind of argument. It's the kind of thing that people have been using for years and years, but young people, especially now, and adults, in fact, do not have the... what's the most charitable way of putting it? They don't have the thoughtful substance that allows them to make sense out of something like that, because their thoughtful substance is replaced by emotional impulse. The emotional impulse is go with your gut, go with your feelings. I saw it, goodness gracious, I saw it in the Lord of the Rings last couple nights ago. What is your heart telling you? This is the worst advice you could ever give anybody. And there it was, Gandalf, or maybe it was Aragorn given that. So this is a dumb line that shows up in movies, but it does identify the way people make decisions by and large nowadays. Follow your heart. Follow your heart. That means follow your emotions, by the way, in the way we understand the word heart. And that isn't what the biblical reference meant. The bowels were the center of the emotions. The heart was the center of the self, not the emotions. And following your heart in the emotional sense is among the worst advice you could give people. So anyway, let's go to, Wisconsin. Jacob in Wisconsin. Where in Wisconsin are you, Jake?
Hi, Greg. I'm in the Milwaukee area.
Oh, okay. Have we talked before?
We have not.
Oh, okay. Because I keep track of the weather.
I'm a first-time caller. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Okay. Well, glad to talk to you. I just keep track of the Wisconsin weather a little bit because I've got a place way north of you, about 4 hours.
Where at?
Up in the Lac du Flambeau, Woodruff, Minocqua area.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
yeah, straight
area.
North. It is. So what's on your mind, Jacob?
Well, quick story first. I was at my parents' house for dinner tonight. My dad excitedly called me into his study to show me two new books he got, and it was your updated tactics book and the story of reality.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Talk to the author tonight, then.
Oh, man, I'm getting
and
goosebumps.
It blew his mind, so, yeah.
Wow, that's a double whammy.
Yeah,
that's great.
Shout out to you from my dad, Bill.
Yeah.
But,
great.
So here's my question that I've been mulling over for a while. My question is this. How does the triune nature of God remain intact throughout the crucifixion? Or, in other words, in what capacity was Christ separated from the Father during his crucifixion?
Okay, that's a better way to put the question, Jacob. And the reason I say this is when you say, how could the triune God remain intact, it suggests that there's something about the crucifixion that kind of necessitates some fracture in the divine nature, okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, this cannot happen because a nature is not divisible like that. Especially God's nature, because he's immutable. Now, our natures could, in principle, go in or out of existence. Well, it's in existence, so it could go out. I don't think it will, but in principle it could, because we are not self-existent. We're contingent. God is self-existent. He is the ground of existence. It is not possible for God to go out of existence or for his nature to change. He's immutable, okay? If his nature is triune, there cannot be a split in the nature. If what we mean by that is a genuine, use a big philosophical word here, but you probably know what it means, ontological split. That means a split in his being. Now, I know that pastors and Bible teachers will sometimes talk about God turning his back on Jesus and the cross and being separated from the Father and things like that. And I think we have to remind ourselves, and the pastors and teachers themselves should be clear, that they are speaking somewhat analogically and not realistically. They don't mean, in fact, God's nature split off, or they ought not mean that, because if they do, then they're just wrong and they don't understand this particular issue clearly. But it does raise a question, and this is the second way you put it. So you're with me so far, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It does raise a question about Jesus' comment on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yes.
And this is the point at which pastors will say that's when God turned his back on Jesus. Now, I think we can get some clues about what's going on there by looking at the passage that Jesus was citing when he said that, because this isn't new, this line. This comes from Psalm, I think, 22. I'm going to quickly turn there, because this is an entire psalm that is about the crucifixion. And it starts out with these words. Let me find it. My God, why have you forsaken me? And then the psalmist says this, far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh, my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Well, now we know what the psalmist means when he says, why have you forsaken me? He means that I'm in trouble and you're not delivering me. I'm crying out to you, and you do not answer. I do not know why we have to make anything more of Jesus' comment on the cross than this.
Okay.
Okay? He is in agony. He is being punished by the Father, not delivered by the Father. He is he is, you know, undescribably close with the Father in the triune nature, yet it is one person of the Trinity that is pouring out wrath on the other. And this is, uh-huh. in a human sense, unbearable agony. And I don't think it's just in the human sense. The agony is being felt by God, not just by the human nature of Jesus. By God, mm-hmm. Jesus' divine nature. And if it's being felt by Jesus' divine nature, guess what other persons of the Trinity are feeling it?
Right. Father and the Spirit.
God is feeling it. Yeah. Insofar as if we understand feelings of it correctly, there's some ambiguity about even how to take that. But what this doesn't teach is that there's somehow some split in the divine nature. All it's teaching, all it's displaying here is the agony of the God-man on the cross being receiving the punishment of the Father that is due us. And he uh-huh. cries out in agony, and I think going back to Psalm 22 helps us to see that more clearly.
Okay.
That help?
Yeah, I think so. I think you nailed it with the, I guess I always assumed from Christ's words on the cross that there was some sort of literal forsakenness rather than...
Well, there was a forsaking, but you talked about kind of split or his nature no longer intact. And so that's not what's going on at all. But there is a kind of forsaking, and that is the thing that stimulates the cry that the Son has before the Father. So some people take it as his loss of faith, you know. But when you read the context and characteristically, if you go back to Old Testament passages that are repeated in the New Testament, sometimes you learn something that really helps you understand what's going on. And I think Psalm 22, by the way, is a whole psalm that looks like a description of a crucifixion from the perspective uh-huh. of the one crucified. You know, they pierced my uh-huh. hands and my feet. I'm looking for the passage right now. They, just going from memory, they, I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. Strength is blah, 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 blah. Dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count on my bones. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. Of course, that happened at Jesus' crucifixion. So I have one Bible teacher a long time ago who actually said that he believes that Jesus recited the whole psalm when he was on the cross. And the very last verse, by the way, is, they will come and will declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has performed it.
Uh-huh.
It might be a way of saying it is accomplished or it is finished.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that's a speculation, but something to think about. All right?
Understood. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yes, you're so welcome, Jacob. Thank you for the call. Let's go quickly over to Donald in Colorado, getting short on time here, so I want to get as many in as possible. Donald, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Greg. It's my first time here. I'm pretty excited.
Okay. I'm glad you are. I'm looking at your question here. Why don't you go ahead and ask it?
Okay, yeah. So I was at work one day. I'm a security guard, so we don't do a whole lot. So we're just talking philosophy, me and one other guy. He's a pretty ardent atheist.
Uh-huh.
Believes Christianity to be pretty unreasonable. He's a moral vegan in that he's a vegan, and I guess the most important reason behind it is because it's moral. I happen to mention to him that...
Did you say he's a moral vegan?
Well, okay, that's not...
Like V-E-G-A-N?
Right. Yeah.
In other words, he's a vegan who believes. Oh, okay. So he's
right, that's what I mean by that.
So he thinks eating animals is wrong. Okay, got you. Okay.
Right. So I said,
but he's an atheist.
Yes, and a bit before that, I did mention I was a Christian. And he was like, "Okay, cool." And then I guess the conversation somehow went to the whole eating animals thing. So I said, "Well, my Christian worldview, animals, it's not wrong to eat animals. Correct me if I'm wrong. They're a resource essentially for humans, correct? They're provided
mm-hmm.
for sustenance for man. So I guess he shot back with a gotcha question that he's pitched towards other Christians who said the same thing. And he says, if God told you to eat children, would you do it? And it gave me a pause. I was like, Well, okay.
So let me try to respond to this, because I do think this is what's going on. This is a gotcha kind of question. Okay.
Yeah.
My first response would be, now that I'm thinking about it, my first response would be, are you serious? Is that a serious question? Or are you just making it? I'm delivering this in a very sober tone, because it is serious to me. Are you serious? Is that a serious question? Yeah, that's my serious question. If God told you to eat your children, would you do it?
Yeah.
And then my second question would be, why would you ask a question like that? And what does that have to do with this conversation? Because all you're saying is that God gave food for human beings. By the way, this is not controversial. You look around the world, and carnivores and omnivores eat other things that had been alive, other critters, other creatures. Why is this controversial? Okay? It has nothing to do with what God says. This is an obvious point. Now, we have a theological grounding. God made the world for us in this way, but why would anybody... So what I'm not even going to do is I'm not even going to treat this as a serious question, and he's going to have to explain to me why it is a serious question before I'm going to address it. What does that have to do with anyone? If God told you to eat your children, would you do it? We're not talking about eating children. We're talking about having a hamburger.
Yeah.
Why is this morally controversial?
I'm trying to see it from his perspective, and I think the idea he was bringing a bigger question to the picture, in that he was trying to debunk the whole idea that morality is from God's nature. So I think he was just trying to give that question.
Fine. Let's go with that. If he thinks that there's a problem with that, I mean, my answer to this question is it's a foolish question, because that's not something God would ever tell me to do. Not the God that I believe in. So why are you asking that question? If my mother were a trolley car, would she have wheels? Well, if she were a trolley car, she would have wheels, but she's not a trolley car. So this question doesn't take us anywhere.
That's right. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that does make sense. I'd have to assume something about how he understands the nature of God in order to answer his question, which...
Well, no, I think he's got a bigger problem, and the bigger problem is he's the atheist who thinks eating animals is wrong. So if you don't ground your morality in God, where are you grounding it? Generally, it's in nature, in evolution. Well, we have not evolved the idea that eating animals is wrong. Nobody believes that except for a couple of... No adjectives. Vegans. Okay? I was going to say goofy vegan. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with vegans, and I respect people to have this view. But for them to act like this is the morally superior view in a world that is governed by evolution, by their own admission, how does that work? That doesn't work.
Yeah, I definitely could have followed on with that.
So I'm going to... Okay, notice, and I'm not trying to make fun of him, but I think that there's some silliness in this. And and he seems to feel, from what you've said, really proud of the fact that he's stonewalled Christians with this kind of comment. When these kind of things come up, sometimes it's just better to question their seriousness, because the challenge is not a serious challenge. And what's his alternative? Okay, so maybe God doesn't help me to know what's right and wrong. You think eating meat is wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, because it's...
I really wanted to ask that, but I was too shy. I mean, the conversation kind of just died right there. And the last thing he said was, I find the flaws in people's beliefs and let them implode on themselves or something.
Okay.
And then we just kind of... So in his view,
but he was probably a street epistemologist guy, I suspect, based on him using the questions in that way.
Yeah.
But what the question to ask then, if he said that, is what is the flaw in my own thinking? What is the flaw? Make him identify the flaw. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's true. It was just hard for me to answer, because it was like, oh man, because I immediately thought of it like he wanted a yes or no question. And of course,
yes or no.
If I say yes, you know, okay, God's asking me to do something morally reprehensible, so I just said yes to that, and no, if I say no, that means there's a moral standard outside of God, which by definition would not make him God. So it was like that. I was stuck, and he kind of got me with that, but that's only because I didn't have the I guess, the wit to respond.
Yeah, well, look, it don't feel bad. It happens to me, too, okay? And it's easier for me. I'm not under pressure. I get the question from you, and I can think of what I'd say. I don't always think of something clever when I'm in the middle of something heated like that, and this is where it's easy to get stonewalled, and why it's valuable once you've been stonewalled like this to do what we're doing, and that is to reflect back on the conversation and think, now what would you say next time he does this? Now, have you, Donald, have you read the Tactics book?
I actually bought it on Amazon on Kindle not too long ago. I'm on the first couple of chapters.
Okay, but, is it the older?
I
hate to say
it's
it.
It's the new one. Definitely the new
it's
one,
the
yeah.
new one. Okay, good. Because there is a chapter there called Turnabout. And the chapter is all about how people, particularly those that are students of an atheist named Peter Boghossian, have been taught to use questions to do what the atheist did with you when he asked you that. What I think is a completely silly question. Okay,
yeah.
he got you with the gotcha question because you're kind of stonewalled. You're thinking, I don't know how to, if I say yes, I'm stuck. If I say no, I'm stuck. Well, that's because of the way the question is worded. And this is why, you know, we're buying some time by saying, wait, are you serious? Why would you ask that question? And then let them talk it out a little bit and try to, because I don't think it's a fair question. It's not a fair question at all.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, I think, the way the Boghossian approach called street epistemology ends up working, is it works against the Christian in an unfair way. It catches them by surprise, and then they don't know. And then they don't know what to say. And so what I did is, in that chapter, I went through some examples of that, and even some examples that happened to me on the show from one of Boghossian's disciples, and showed how this was illicit, and I recommend ways of dealing with those kinds of things. However, as you just learned, it's not always easy on your feet. And that's why it's good to go through afterwards and do some reflection. Donald, I'm glad you called. We're out of time here. You might jump ahead just for fun and read that chapter titled Turnabout. That is how to deal with people when they use Columbo against you, questions against you. And that might help. Thanks so much for the call. And thank you, folks, for this hour together. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.